This is Scott Becker with Becker's Hospital Review. I'm thrilled today to be joined by Doug Watson. Doug is a senior chief financial officer with the CommonSpirit Health System. We're going to ask Doug a bunch of questions about healthcare. Doug, can you take a moment and introduce yourself?
Sure, Scott. It's great to have an opportunity to talk with you. Again, Doug Watson. I'm the chief financial officer for the Arizona division of CommonSpirit Health and Dignity Health. And based here in Phoenix, we're about a $7.5 billion division of the overall CommonSpirit Health. So we have health plans, hospitals, the Barrow Institute, a number of other aspects of the healthcare continuum all active here in the Phoenix market.
Well, fantastic. Let me ask you the general question. Two or three thoughts on the state of healthcare currently. You could take it whatever direction you want, and then we'll get into some more specific questions about the CFO role and more.
Sure, Scott. One of the things that I think is really striking right now, and I've been in the industry for quite a while, is that we have got a very unique set of things happening today. First of all, from an innovation standpoint, this is probably the most interesting time in history in the country, in the world, but also in healthcare. We're seeing innovations on technology, equipment, and medical devices that can do things we could not have done even a few years ago. We're starting to see real progress. We have just got a $50 million grant to work on a cure for brain tumors, and we're focusing on doing it using the types of thinking that came out of Silicon Valley of fail fast, try a lot of different things. Again, something that we just didn't do in clinical trials even a few years ago that we're now able to do and think about very differently. But at the same time, in the industry, we're faced with some real challenges that are, from a clinical perspective, really startling. I mean, you think about the fact that now suicide is the top leading cause of death for a number of age categories of people, certainly in Arizona, and I suspect it's similar in other parts of the country. Maternal mortality is going down. I mean, we're actually seeing situations where, it's going up, which is a down statistic. We're seeing more women die in childbirth than we have seen historically and certainly compared to the rest of the world. And you think about that compared to the innovation and the things that we're doing to really improve health, and you just sort of ask yourself, well, why is that? What's wrong? What are we not doing correctly that's allowing that sort of thing to happen? We also have the opioid crisis, which I know you've covered, Scott, at Becker's, and many other people have across the country, but it's having a profound impact on healthcare in the country. And then the third thing that's happening is we're seeing cost shifting in different ways than what we've seen historically. And so with the high deductible health plans, with the shifts that employers are doing to push more cost to individuals and to and also in the business world, that's also creating issues. We have more challenges now with patients who, quote, have insurance but really don't have enough coverage. And so they're ending up with very significant patient balances after insurance is paid, which is affecting their ability to get the care that they need and also affecting, in some cases, whole families where we're having medical bankruptcies as a country at levels that really aren't sustainable. And so we really have to think about how do we use that innovation and how do we use some of the creative things that we can come up with to get the cost of healthcare more affordable, but also to sort of figure out how do we make it a more equitable distribution of the cost as well. So it's a very exciting time, I think. There are no easy answers to any of these things, but it's a very exciting time to be a part of an organization that's trying to solve them.
So you've really mentioned really a best of times, worst of times scenario, which I think is exactly right on, and you really focused on three different things. Tremendous innovation, aside from the device side, the pharma side, the precision medicine side, the brain tumor side, innovation that has, in the last 5 years, accelerated so much compared to the last 30 years, the tremendous innovation. At the same time, tremendous increase in behavioral health problems throughout the country, as well as real disparities in healthcare access. And then the third issue, which sort of ties into a number of them, is this issue of cost shifting and just more and more patient burden on everything, and everybody needing some family member that could afford it, because it's become, extremely challenging, and there's just not access to some of this innovation. without the economics. So a fascinating summary and just great, Doug. You're a CFO. You serve as CFO of now what's really a $7 billion division of a huge system, the first or second largest not-for-profit system in the country. What's the biggest role of the CFO today? Is the core role making sure all the accounting gets done right, the reporting gets done right? But doesn't it go way past that? What's the core role, and how do you view the core role of a CFO today?
Well, Scott, it definitely has gone way past that. We're fortunate as a large organization to be able to afford shared service functions and things like that that can take care of the accounting, making sure payroll gets done, the sorts of things that a CFO used to spend a lot of time doing in the past can now be done on a scale and can be done accurately and efficiently. And so the CFO really can start to spend and should be spending most of their time. I kind of view it as being a partner and an enabler of the strategy and innovation. So as you are trying to solve the problems we just talked about, the CFO really has, I think, an important role. Partially, and I kind of view it as the financial conscience of the organization, are we making good business decisions, but not just from a protection of capital perspective, but also from, are we investing in the right things? Are we taking the right risks? Are we looking at where we can make an impact on things, and are we getting out in front of it enough? In the past, I think often CFOs were sort of maligned as being the no people. So we were always the ones who said, well, it's not in the budget. We can't afford it. We can't do it. As a CFO today, you really have to be more of, okay, that's the right thing to do, either clinically, ethically, morally, from a business standpoint. So then how are we going to do it? And more it becomes, you know, here's what we can do as our organization. Now, how am I going to interact with CFOs and or CEOs of other organizations in the community to marshal the resources in total so we can tackle some of these things? So it really has transcended being a technical person of understanding the numbers and making sure the numbers and the data is right to being, okay, here's the information. Now, how are we going to marry that with the objectives of the organization, the strategy, the problems we're trying to solve, and then be an active participant working with your chief executive officer, working with the strategy team, working with the operations team to then actually make it happen. And you're bringing a technical perspective, so you're bringing some rigor to the financials of saying, okay, well, let's make sure we really understand how much financial risk we're taking, how are we going to mitigate it, what are our plans if we, you know, get into this and something doesn't go the way we thought it would. But you're also the person who's going to figure out, well, how do we make it happen? How do we connect the dots? And I think that's a really important part of being a CFO today.
And so much less no, but much more yes, and how can we do it? It really the transition, and really the transition to really partner with every organization, every operation within the hospital. Yes, the numbers have to be done right and lots of help to make sure those things are done right, but then a much more global role in terms of intersecting with the rest of the organization. But let me ask you a different question, coming back to the macro of healthcare. It seems as though the percentage of Medicare and Medicaid business that everybody is doing is growing. And obviously, there's that's just the reality due to an aging population, aside from other things. How does this impact margins? Big impact, small impact, incremental impact? Any thoughts on that? And this is not an anti-Medicare rant. This is the reality of, I think, many of us, whether you're a Medicare for all political person or not, many of us have great concern that if there's not a public option of some sort or some kind of way to access insurance, it's going to be a real problem. So this is not meant to be anti-Medicare, Medicaid at all. It's 50% plus of the healthcare economy. But what does it do to margins of a hospital, and how has that shifted over the years?
Well, that's a good question, Scott, and I think it's very different in different parts of the country. but I certainly think nationally we're seeing this demographic trend, which is a clear reality. We're seeing births declining. We're seeing people aging in place. And as a population, we're aging. And so we are seeing more shift in Medicare in particular. And what I think you also have to recognize with Medicare is as people age, the amount of health care they need also goes up. And we all know that, you know, Medicare per member per month rates are far higher than typical commercial per member per month rates because the health care needs of a person as they age go up, and they go up fairly significantly as they continue to age into the 80s and 90s. And we're going to have the largest populations of 80 and 90 year olds that this country's ever seen here soon. And that's a real challenge when Medicare is structured really as a program that if things are working well and you're very efficient and everything goes right, you almost cover your cost. It's not structured as a model, at least traditional fee-for-service Medicare, of where you're going to get cost plus a significant profit. And so you can't make that up in volume. You have to figure out how either we're going to work in the value-based world through Medicare risk to figure out how do we change the management of the care in order to be able to keep people healthy, figure out how we can capture some of the risk income that way. And we have to figure out how we're going to be more efficient and how we're going to manage to provide high-quality care in a personal way to patients as they age. And as they, you know, those folks still expect a personal touch. And we're seeing fewer and fewer people in the workforce to provide that personal touch. That's another thing we spend a lot of time and have spent a lot of time thinking about here at Common Spirit, particularly here in Phoenix. I think you covered in Becker's review some of what we're doing with Creighton to develop a four-year medical school here and to also be able to educate a lot of the other medical professionals, nurses, physician assistants, nurse practitioners, others, because we have to figure out how we're going to have enough people to actually take care of those retirees that are coming down the road. Interestingly, in Arizona, Medicaid is fairly flat because we have a very strong economy. And so Medicaid is a relatively stable part of our business right now and actually declining a little bit as a percentage. But Medicare is definitely increasing as a percentage of our business.
Fascinating. And then in terms of the workforce, I mean, what's becoming abundantly clear every day is, one, obviously healthcare is a very labor-intensive business, and it's very hard to change that because we all do want the care and the people and the help. And two is there's not enough providers. I mean, when you look at specialties in certain areas, rural areas, no OB-GYNs, no psychiatrists, and just overall a need for more specialists and somehow or another and providers of all sorts, and have to at some point champion the development of more of those, like the development of the med school program you're talking about, and like you see some other systems doing, just as a sheer necessity. You have the level of physicians and providers and at every level to make this work for the next 10, 20, 30 years, and then forever. A different question. To save cost, and I'd love your thoughts on this, people talk about rationing care. And my observation is rationing care is sort of like taxes. Rationing care is fine as long as it's not your family's care being rationed. You know, rationing care at the end of life is great as long as it's not your family member whose care is getting rationed when you want to try everything. Any thoughts on some of these discussions of rationing care and how do you sort of manage care for 350 million people? And this might be a bigger, more challenging question. Any thoughts on this? And any thoughts on some of these subjects?
Sure, Scott. I mean, the term rationing care immediately gets a reaction from people because it's something that just sort of inherently feels unfair. But as a country, we ration care today. I mean, the reality is we do it through economic terms and who has insurance, who can get access to care in certain areas. And it's very different in urban markets versus rural markets. But it's being done in a very inexplicit way, as opposed to some other countries. I mean, if you look at Canada and some of the European countries, they're much more explicit about saying if you are X years old and you have these three conditions, you don't qualify for open heart surgery, and we're not going to approve it, and you're not going to get it, because they've concluded from some statistical mathematical conversation that the return isn't there for the for the state, and they're not willing to do it. We have chosen not to do that sort of thing as a country, and I think that's a good thing. But I do think we also have to recognize that unless we can do something to ensure that there's access for everyone, and that's not as simple as let's just pass a law that says everybody has access to a primary care doctor if we haven't figured out how to have enough primary care doctors or enough aligned practice professionals around those primary care doctors to be able to actually provide that. And that's been part of the problem. That's one of the things we really faced through the Affordable Care Act, is we created a lot of access expectations without creating additional workforce with which to supply that. And that's something I think as a country we really have to wrestle with, is everybody deserves the ability to have good health care. Fundamental tenet of what Common Spirit believes, and certainly what many people believe. The question is how, and what does that mean in terms of a minimum level or some level of care that we all agree is the right thing to do? And there are no easy answers to that, but we certainly can do better in this country than we have today. I mean, this is, I think, what are we up to, about 16-17% of GDP? So you think about the fact that very soon we'll be at 20% of our economy is devoted to healthcare, and yet we can't actually take care of all the people. Not that there isn't enough money in the system, it's just not getting to the right places in many cases.
But you've made a very important point that's often lost on people, but is becoming more clear to everybody. Access and financing are one part of it. The other part of it is actual capacity. And there's just not going to be capacity at the right level in all places. And so how do you sort of manage that? So you're not going to have the same kind of capacity in a rural part of Arizona as you do in Phoenix or Scottsdale. And that's just because small population might not be able to support it, but you've still got to make sure that there's sufficient capacity for people to get adequate and good care. And it seems like a very challenging problem.
It is, and we're certainly looking at telehealth as one area, which is a very broad term, but thinking about if you've got rural, we have a collaborative across the state with some of the smaller facilities and other facilities of other parts of the state, where we work together to try to figure out how can we help each other to do better care, try to keep care local, which is something Common Spirit and Dignity have believed all along, that care is better as close to the person's home as possible. I think you covered some of what we're trying to do with Contessa in terms of having a hospital at home, so we can push care all the way into people's home when we can. And so when you think about rural areas, telehealth is certainly one piece of it, is how do you project the resources in the big city out into the local community, in the rural community. We also have to think about robotics. And, you know, if you think about the day when we could do, you know, have a robot system in a critical access hospital and a world-renowned neurosurgeon operating that equipment from Phoenix and doing a very complex operation in a rural market, that couldn't be done today, but we're pretty close to being able to technically do that. And so there's a lot of things we'll be able to do using technology, I think, to extend the resources we do have. We just have to get creative. And then the other barrier is today's payment mechanisms that were designed in the 50s and 60s don't have an ability to finance that sort of thing. You know, there's no CPT code for a remote surgery that's done far away. You know, there isn't a good way for us to bill for that today. Even basic telemedicine is only now getting to the point where Medicare and a lot of the health plans fully recognize and pay for a telehealth visit. That's something that's really only just happened in the last couple of years. And that will really help us when we can get it integrated in so that it's, you know, one of the analogies a lot of people use is, you know, nobody talks about telebanking anymore. It's normal to do your banking through your computer, through your phone, and when you need to, go into the branch. But we don't think of it as something separate. We just think of it as banking. So eventually, we need to rethink about healthcare that way. It's however I get it. It's close to where I need it. It's accessible when I want it, and it's being brought in the right setting. So yeah, if I need brain surgery, I'm going to go to the branch. I'm going to go to the hospital. But if I just need something more simple, I'm going to get on my computer and try to work through it.
100%. It's, let me switch gears for a moment. You're having this magnificent career as a chief financial officer and and really getting to mix your technical skill with your passion and commitment to communities. Great, great career that you're having. What's your best advice to aspiring professionals, aspiring CFOs? Best advice to people sort of developing their careers?
Well, the first thing I would say, Scott, is, and it's pretty much that way, I think, in every career, you have to have a good technical foundation. So whatever you are in terms of your role, you want to be really good at it. So if you're going to be in finance, you really need to understand the numbers. You need to have a good understanding of the accounting rules, the financing mechanisms, how the different programs work, et cetera. But then you really also, I think, need to take that and get a grounding. I was very fortunate in my career that I started out on the audit side, and I eventually got to do consulting. Eventually, I was able to do a lot of IT work and strategy work and other things. So as a CFO, particularly if you're going to come up through the ranks and you're going to be a, you know, a staff accountant, and you're going to move your way up to a director of finance, and you're going to be really technical through a lot of that, you've got to get out into the organization and drive projects, be involved in technology questions, be involved in operational issues, understand the clinical questions. Not that you're going to be a clinician, but you have to be able to speak to clinicians in a way that they can understand what you're saying and you can understand what they're trying to accomplish. We used to call it being conversationally literate in some of these different areas. I mean, you need to know enough to be able to have that crucial conversation to understand what you're trying to accomplish and what they're trying to accomplish and figure out how you bridge it together. And that's probably the number one thing I would say is for an aspiring CFO, when you get that assignment to be on the IT steering committee, don't be the scorekeeper. Don't be the person who's only looking at the budget and reporting out the budget numbers every month. Take your role seriously. Be in the mix on the IT decisions. Same thing if you're on a performance improvement or a turnaround group, or you're trying to evaluate a new business plan. Don't be the person who just crunches the numbers and says, here's the answer. Be the person who crunches the numbers and then says, and now here are the implications of this, and here are the three or four things that we need to think about differently. And then go work with the operations person or work with the strategy person hand in hand to figure out how we're going to make a good solution and a good answer. So often I see finance people sort of stay in their finance box and they report out the numbers and they do it very well, but they never get into really being part of the decision and really driving it with your expertise and being a partner with your strategy person, with your operations person, so that it's you're right in the middle of it, not just accounting for it. And that's the number one piece of advice.
I think that's magnificent advice. So at the end of the day, you've got to be great at your day job, which is your technical job, the numbers, et cetera. But then you've got to lean in and be part of the process for everything else and not want to stay in your small box. You've got to be great in your box, but then you also want to be beyond that. That's what I'm sort of hearing from you, Doug.
Absolutely, and I think it applies probably across. You know, if you're a physician, if you're a nurse, if you're an IT person, you got to be great in your technical role, but you also need to be a part of the leadership of the organization. You need to be out there helping us make good decisions, helping raise the question we didn't think about, or raising the implication that we didn't think about.
In a different final question for you, Doug, you've done a terrific job. I see your energy level. I see your enthusiasm. I see your intelligence. How do you keep yourself motivated and keep going, throughout the course of a career? What keeps you motivated? How do you stay after it?
Well, that's a really good question, Scott. And a couple of different things. One, when you are having a rough day and you sort of feel a little frustrated, I usually just try to get out of my office, walk across the street to the hospital, or like today, I'm actually in the East Valley out at our Mercy Gilbert campus, and I had a chance this morning after our monthly operating review meeting with the senior leadership here to go with the team out to the floors, and we had three amazing race winners, so we had an amazing race promotion where we were having all the different departments in the hospital somewhat compete in a friendly way for patient satisfaction and other statistics that we measure to, try to drive some improvement. And we had three winners, and I got to go up and present, some small dollar awards that they can now use to do something with their team. But it's really rewarding. I mean, it makes you really feel good to know that there are people there that are touching patients directly that are motivated and excited about things, and that really helps recharge me. It's also great when you can work, and I have the opportunity to be on a number of other boards, but sometimes you are in a meeting, in a board meeting, and you're looking at things from a very different perspective. That also helps. And then one of the things I encourage folks to do is to go to conferences. Obviously, I've been a strong supporter of Becker's. I think every time I go, I learn things and I get to meet different people and you get to recharge and think about different things. Same thing with the Catholic Health Association meeting every year. You go and you talk a lot about the why, not the how and other things, but you talk about, well, why are we doing this? Why does this matter from an ethical and other perspectives? And then the last thing, which I also tell our folks, is take your vacation. You know, sometimes it's really important. I think the Monty Python said it very well, but sometimes you need something completely different. And you need to just discharge, you know, just detach from things, go on your vacation. And what I often find is by the time I'm getting to the end of it, I've got a fresh thought about some of the things I was wrestling with before I left. And I've hopefully had some good time with my family and friends. And you come back recharged. I worry about people who don't try to get out and take their vacation. It's easy to get caught up in the never-ending things we need to do in healthcare. But it is really important to get away, spend time with your family, your friends, see things from other perspectives, and just relax sometimes.
I think that's fantastic. I sort of got four things from you. One is you've got to get back to the core mission periodically. And for you, that means getting back to hospitals, the health systems, actually seeing what's going on with the team and patients and staff and so forth. Second, you've got this cross, you know, ability to pollinate by being in different boards, different situations, being able to think of things across lines, and it keeps you energized and excited, a little bit different. Third is you'll get out to annual conferences, events, and so forth. You mentioned, obviously, the Catholic Health Association. I won't make a note of ours just for avoiding the self-promotion. But you go to meetings, and part of that is just like, a lot of it's not even just learning something. It's just energizing, getting, seeing peers and colleagues and revisiting. And the fourth thing you said, which I think is just so important, and they're all important, is that taking your vacations, taking your time, setting boundaries. Oh, so when you do come back to work, when you do come back to your core business or job, whatever it is, you've got the energy and excitement for it, and you're not so burnt out. So I just think great advice, Doug. Just a pleasure.
No, it's really important. And that's the other nice thing about conferences is you so often get to see people you haven't seen in years, which is one of the treats for me. I've been in the industry for a long time, so I'll go to a conference. And inevitably, you run into one or two people you haven't seen in 10 or 15 years. They're doing something very different than what they used to do when you knew them. And you get talking about things, and more often than not, I get a nugget of a great idea, or in some cases, as an example of what we're doing with Contessa, it was a CFO that I'd worked with back at Anderson that had worked with me at another health system for a while, and now is with another a completely different health system in the Midwest, and we got talking about some things, and one thing led to another, and I found a solution to a problem I had. So it's really rewarding to be able to do that, not only personally, but also professionally.
Oh, that's fantastic. Doug, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. It's just always a pleasure to visit with you. I learn so much more when I get a chance to visit with somebody one-on-one like this and just hear what they're thinking, hear where they're coming from, and just a great pleasure. So thank you, Doug, very, very much.
Well, I really appreciate the opportunity, Scott, and hopefully this will be useful to other folks. It's a very exciting industry we're in today, even though we've got plenty of challenges, but I think as a group of professionals, we'll all rise to the occasion and help figure out how to make healthcare in this country better.
Well, we agree, and just a pleasure visiting with you, Doug. Thank you.
Great. Take care.